The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 414 for Sunday, August 26th, 2012. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, we provide some answers, you send in your tips, we provide some tips of our own. And together, we all enjoy and try. We love learning new things about the Mac. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Glad you got that out. Got that out of your system.
I had to wrap it up somehow. Yep, that's right. Yep. You work with what you got.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun. And I like the episode number for one reason. And it probably was swimming around in your memory. The significance of that number. Yes.
Yeah, but I am working on literally 3 hours of sleep and a long day in the sun. My entire weekend was devoted to the benefit of kids sports in many different ways. So tell me why 414 sounds familiar to me.
Well, it was the name of a group of people who I gather came from area code. I can't imagine what else here, though. I'm skimming the article here, but it was a group of people that so this was in the 80s when, you know, like War Games was the cool movie and everybody, you know, knew how to be a hacker and Joshua and all that great stuff.
Yep.
And apparently it was a group of people that busted into some computers and got caught.
Oh.
So, but the 414s. So that's why it rung a bell in my mind. And I'm sure as you were saying it, it sounded like you're like, wait, what does this mean?
For people
that remember all those shenanigans. And
was Newt Sears a member of that group? Because that was one of the guys that our friend Jason, we'll keep his last name out of this because he works for a fruit company now, that he introduced me to. And he was this major Unix guy. And I saw his name mentioned in the Cuckoo's Egg, you know, but yeah, he
okay.
Yeah.
I see anyway. No specific names, but it was just a group that made some high profile system compromises and
cool. Yeah. I mean, cool, you know, cool in the sense that that's just, you know, that's how it was back then.
Well, it looks like they did, you know, take some people's time and do a little damage, which is not cool. Kids.
No, damage is bad. Yeah, that's bad. All right. You know, let's start the show with some quick ones, John. I think we got probably four or five questions here that we should be able to bang out and see if we can't get into the groove of this thing here. Dave writes, I'm sorry, what'd you say? Are we good?
We're already in the groove.
All right, good.
Keep going.
Okay. Dave writes, hopefully a quick one. Yes, sir. Indeed. He says, since Mountain Lion, assuming that's the cause, my cursor occasionally changes from a pointer to horizontal arrows pointing left and right. If I take a screenshot, the normal cursor returns. Maybe this is connected to screenshots, maybe to Sketch. Would love your thoughts. Cut me off. All right, Dave. I have seen this. I don't see it. It doesn't sound like I see it as regularly as you do, but I have seen it, and I've seen it on not just my machine, but multiple machines. But it predates the release of Mountain Lion. And while I don't have an answer for you, I do have a perhaps slightly faster way of dealing with this problem. When your cursor gets munged, and you're right, screenshots are the kind of the hint here. When your cursor gets munged, when you go into screenshot mode, especially if you go into, so there's a couple different screenshot modes. So there's a bonus tip here. You can do Command-Shift-3. These are all default commands. Command-Shift-3 will take a picture of the entire screen and save it to the desktop. Command-Shift-4 will give you crosshairs, and then two things can happen. You can draw with the crosshairs, or you can hit the space bar and the crosshairs turn into a camera icon, and you float that over a window, and then you can click and take a picture of just that window, and it gives you like a nice little drop shadow and everything. But anyway, to solve this problem, Command-Shift-4 to get to the crosshairs, and then just hit escape. And then that reverts my cursor back, and it doesn't save the screenshot to the desktop. And one other thing, since we're on screenshots now, Command-Shift-4, Command-Shift-3, save them to the desktop. Command Control Shift 3 or 4. So adding control to the mix saves it not to the desktop, but to the clipboard. So if you want to send someone a screenshot via email, it's really cool. You just do, you know, whichever one. I usually do 4 so I can just get the window or whatever I want. And then I can just go into an email and paste it in, and I didn't have to like drag it from the desktop or do anything funky like that. So, or I can paste it into Sketch, which Dave mentioned, and I do that a lot too. And then I can edit it and fun stuff. So that's my attempt at answering that in a short way and yet still providing all sorts of extra goodies. You want to take, you have anything to add to that, or you want to just take one?
Goody.
All right.
No, good. I got something to add. Well, a little bit to add.
All right, go.
There is one place in macOS where you may want to look that you can affect the behavior of the cursor.
Okay.
And just thought I'd mention it. So if you go to System Preferences, Universal Access Mouse, there is a selection there for changing the cursor size. So just thought I'd mention it because I was looking, I seem to remember now, you know, I think it was third-party add-ons, which probably wreaked all sorts of havoc.
Right. Right.
You know, playing with the cursor and make it animated and, you know, all that nonsense that you really don't need. So that's the only place I can see that you can change the cursor.
All right. What do you got next?
What do I have?
Yeah.
You're implying that I'm ready for this here.
I am.
Question from John. Yeah, certainly could be. Oh, man.
You know, we do. I love this. This actually is funny to me. But, you know, we do an agenda and in theory, we're both on the same page.
There it is. Okay. Right. No, I got it.
Good.
I can't boot to the recovery partition or to the CD to wipe the hard drive for a clean install. Every time I get 3 beeps. So this is mysterious because we have not one but 2 problems here. But I check my profiler and the status for my RAM says it's okay, which is a good instinct because that is usually what beeps mean.
Right.
I think. And it shows 8 gigs. Any help you have would be appreciated. I try to offer 2 pieces of information here. So number one, not being... In the back of my mind, I remember not being able to boot to the recovery partition, and I couldn't understand why, or that there was a number of things I was trying to do and I couldn't do them, and I couldn't figure out why until at one point I held down a certain key and tried to do a certain thing, and all of a sudden I saw a little dialogue asking for a password. And what this is although it's interesting because the support article seems to have been deprecated, as far as I know, you can still do this, though you may have to launch it from the install disk, and that's running open firmware password protection. If you turn that on, you can't do a lot of things like booting to the recovery partition or booting to a DVD or running the startup manager, which was the other thing I suggest that he do. Because if you can get the startup manager, which involves holding down the option key, then you will get a list of all drives that the Mac thinks it can boot from. And at that point... last I checked, the recovery partition shows up there. It doesn't show up in a lot of other places like Disk Utility and some other places you'd expect. So,
all right. Cool. That's
all I got.
That's it.
Moving on.
Works for me. All right. Richard writes, an unusual thing happened when I did the update to 10.8.1 that I thought I would mention to you. I was running 10.8.0. First, I went to the App Store and ran the incremental upgrade to 10.8.1, which only took a few minutes to download and run. After the upgrade was finished, I went back to the App Store, and under the Purchases tab was the 10.8.1 upgrade. It was still there. Unsure if this meant there was a problem with the upgrade, I downloaded it again, this time getting the full install, taking over an hour. I ran the complete install, which also seemed to run fine. After the full install, it still shows download on the Purchases page in the App Store. I do not know why it did this. My best guess is that either, number one, Mountain Lion saw a problem with the upgrade installation and decided that I needed to full install, or number two, my system is a little flaky and did not register that I had run the updater. Actually, Rick, number three is what is the answer here. Apple has what you're seeing is exactly what you should be seeing after a successful update. If you need to update, and this only happens with the operating system, to my knowledge, it used to be that if you wanted to download a copy of the operating system that you had currently installed, you had to jump through all sorts of hoops to do it. Apple has now made that easier. And the way you do it is you navigate to the store, in, you know, in the Mac App Store, and you hit the download button for the OS, and it just downloads it. So if you need to update, or if the OS thinks you need to update, it will show an update button, not the download button. So what you're seeing is totally normal. It's a little different than it was. I don't know. It just changed maybe 3 months ago. But it is normal. So your actually your incremental upgrade to 10.8.1 went very well. So you did not need to go through all that red tape that you went through. But it seems like your system is still running fine. So there you go. Moving on, John. Or do you have
totally out left field?
Yeah, that's
I've noticed this. No, I just thought I'd mention this because I noticed it the other day. Have you noticed that in certain file views that when a file is downloading, it now shows you a little progress bar?
Yeah.
To tell you what the size is.
In the Finder, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
I just noticed that the other day. I'm like, oh, isn't that?
It shows
a lot of times I think we've seen that stale size values are sometimes a problem. So it looks like they took care of it, and that. Yeah, if you see the little bar, it's saying I'm busy with this. Just a nice little touch that I think was new within, the last OS, I guess.
Yeah, it totally new to Mountain Lion. Yeah, that's it's interesting that I get that in the Finder when I'm doing copies just for locally or, you know, from a network drive or whatever. It you know, it just shows it right there on the size. That's handy. I like it. You know, while we're on a tangent related to 10.8.1, I should mention, first of all, I've updated most, if not all, of my Mountain Lion machines to 10.8.1, and it has gone very, very smoothly. And so I do recommend it. Have you had good experience with yours too, John?
So far.
Good. Good.
I only have one problem, but that's for another time.
Okay. All right. Jim Tanis, otherwise known as MGG Jim, did a ton of testing for us recently at TMO and found that battery life with Mountain Lion is significantly worse than it was with Lion before it on the same machine. And I mean, he's gone through all sorts of crazy tests and the articles are up at TMO. We'll put a link to one or two of them here in the show notes too. But 10.8.1 does make it better. It's still not up to 10.7.4 battery life rates, but 10.8.1 definitely made a big difference on the portables that he tested. And he tested, I think, three different portables: regular MacBook Pro, Retina MacBook Pro, and MacBook Air. So, just thought I'd throw that out there. It's very interesting stuff. But there you go. All right. What's that? Let's see. Oh, you know, Dave writes, he says, guys, do you have any idea why Mail App creates duplicate naming when I only type in an address once? Every once in a while, I see in the to field, it'll say, you know, email@domain.com/email@domain.com. And it'll all be in that same blue bubble that you're used to seeing just the person's name or the single address in. Why is this happening? This is when you get an email from someone and their name is not attached to the address in the headers. Mail stores everything. If you reply to them, any message you send out, Mail stores the addresses that are in that, in the to and the CC and even the BCC headers. It stores those in your previous recipients list. If it does not have a name to attach to it, it actually puts the email address in as the name. And sometimes that causes things to be duplicated. And I think that's what you're seeing here. You can muck about with this, though, by going in Mail to the window menu and go to previous recipients. You'll get a big long list set up, and you can do a couple of things here. You can remove people from the list, and you can do a little search in there. It's actually really, really handy. You can see the last time it was used, and then you can also take them and add it to your contacts if you're so inclined. So that's probably where you're going to find these things, and they're just going to look a little funky out there because they don't have names associated with them. So. Any thoughts on that, John, while I sip some tea?
Dude, I just saw that. Oh, this is awesome. I'm like sorting it by time, and it's like a peek into my past and my former enemies and all that.
Wait, what?
This is great.
You know, combining the last two questions here, John, 10.8.1 changed some things with mail. If you're using the, if you're looking at messages in mail, if you look at, pull up a message, and it doesn't matter if you're in regular view or classic view, I guess they call it. If you look at the headers in the message, it no longer says from colon and then the name of the person it's from. And it also no longer says subject colon. And that changed in 10.8.1. I just pointed out, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
You want another one?
You go.
Well, I'm not quite sure what to do with this yet, but you notice what happens when you highlight multiple emails?
No.
Are you in the classic view? Well, I'm in the classic view. Basically, it makes like a little 3D-ish pile.
Oh, look at that.
I don't remember doing before. And I'm trying to figure out why that's useful. I mean, it's nice eye candy, but I suspect there's more you can do with it.
I doubt it. You can't do anything. I mean, you can drag them around, but it's not... It's just eye candy. It's like on the iPad or whatever. I think that's where that.
Stop that. Well, I got to shake my fist when eye candy is the reason they do something. Come on.
Well, you know, it's that's how Apple rolls.
I suppose. But, you know, I just feel bad for the people that couldn't upgrade to Mountain Lion because they didn't have quite powerful enough graphics chipset.
Yeah.
Our hats off to you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, there you go.
It's not the end of the world, though, right?
It is not the end of the world. All right, John. The last quick one here. Well, it might not be the last quick one, but certainly the last in this list. Chris writes, I have a friend who needs Mac assistance from time to time. Trying to walk them through steps via the phone doesn't cut it. I need to parachute into their computer and show them how to fix their issues or simply fix what's ailing. What do you recommend for easy remote access? Needs to be something quick, easy, and simple to set up. What's your suggestion? So, the two that jump to mind for the quick and easy and most importantly, free for personal use are LogMeIn's offering and TeamViewer. I think either one of those is probably the going to be a good answer for you. But John, I know you always have good stuff to suggest, and especially when this very question comes up.
Well, it's pretty much what you said, though. I'll point you to a specific piece of TeamViewer. So that's the one that I really like.
Yep.
But they have a special version of what you want to do. So when you go to the TeamViewer page, and then there's a download link, and then what you're going to see, it's going to list Mac things or different versions for the Mac.
Okay.
The one I think you want to get for at least the recipient is TeamViewer Quick Support. That one doesn't go through the full, from what I recall, formal installation process, you know, with requiring an admin password and stuff like that. It pretty much just starts up. I think you may have to create an account with them, but other than that, yeah, actually you may not even not. I think that was the attraction here.
That's
they run
great.
It, some numbers come up on the screen, you talk to them, because what happens is with a lot of these solutions is that both parties are registering with someone else that helps them find each other. And so one thing you got to think about is, do I trust them? And, you know, TeamViewer, I guess I trust them just as do you trust those other guys?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's it. Right. Yeah. You are using them as kind of the, you know, conduit that makes things easy. And yeah, in the chat room, which actually we did not audibly welcome the folks in the chat room. So welcome to everyone there in the chat room. Our Sunday evening chat room is growing and growing. MacGeekab.com/stream every time we record the show, which will not be happening next Sunday because of various travel and things. But we will do a show for next week. We'll keep you posted as to when that'll happen. But somebody in the chat room, John, is saying TeamViewer QS doesn't have to install. So that's, there you go.
Okay, quick support, the thing I mentioned.
Yep, you mentioned. Yep.
Okay, so I did identify the right program.
Yep. Awesome. All right.
Where are we?
So in addition to the chat room, you know, John, we have the Mac Geek Gab crew forums, and things have been, there's always some great stuff out there. And so we have, We have a couple of things to go through from the forums, I believe. Let's talk about one from Rarivapa. Rarivapa, and these are forum names, so, you know, bear with us on this, folks. Writes, I have the following setup. I have a fiber optic modem. That's my access to the internet. I have a Linksys router with PPPoE setup connected to the internet as it works. It also has wireless enabled on it. I have two Airport Extremes, and I have home automation equipment, which requires a network. The reason I had the Linksys router is because the WAN connection through the Airport Extreme resulted in a very slow internet connection. I don't know why, but it doesn't really matter. How can I extend the Linksys Wi-Fi Ethernet with the help of the Airport Extremes? I have computers, home automation equipment, which requires everything to be on the same network so that I can share the files, music across PCs, Macs, and other iOS devices. Yeah, of course. So this is one of my favorite topics because it's the wireless router vendors would like us to believe that it's very, very easy and reliable and fast even to simply put the base stations into wireless network extension mode or WDS mode, it's sometimes called. But, you know, the general concept there is you set up one router that broadcasts the wireless network, and then you have other routers that just like grab that wireless signal and repeat it to areas of your home that that, you know, might not get the signal from the first one. Sounds great. I've never seen it work. I've talked to one person who has had great luck with it. But by and large, I probably tried this in more than 50 homes and have never, not my own homes, but with other folks, and personally have never, ever seen it work. But that led me to a much better solution and perhaps one that's even better for you because you're looking to extend not just your wireless, but your Ethernet as well. I love Powerline. What Powerline does is it allows you to essentially leverage your power outlets in the house and connect them to your Ethernet network. You get power line adapters and you need at least two because you're going to plug them in on either end. And they're very simple. They plug into a wall outlet and they have an Ethernet port on them. And pretty much that's the extent of your configuration. You plug them in and you can treat them like Ethernet outlets. Some homes wiring is too old to support these, but by and large, they tend to work very, very well. The things do not need to be on the same circuits. They just need to all go to the same circuit panel. The signal will happily jump from circuit to circuit there. And I get almost 200 megabits a second with either the 200 megabit per second units or the 500 megabit per second units. And I've mostly tried just the Netgear stuff. But my guess is that other Powerline stuff would work. So using Powerline, if assuming you don't have Ethernet run around your house, you set up your first router, you run Powerline from that to a second airport router. You let that go into wireless access point mode where it's just broadcasting a signal but not doing any routing. You put it into bridge mode. You do that with another one, put them in the right spots of the house, and you're good to go. Use Powerline yet? I guess you probably don't need it in your house, right, John?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about it. So I actually just purchased a couple of, because I'm reviewing more network products. And
right.
As it turns out, I've kind of run out of ports, Dave. So I ordered from our pals at Monoprice. They had a special one day I couldn't resist. They had a little tweet, and it was a $20 8-port gigabit router switch.
Dude, okay.
For $20. And it That's looks awesome. Like, it doesn't look like a piece of garbage, but they, you know, they limit it to 5 per member or,
sure.
Or buy. So, because I need more ports, but I got two because the thing is, I'm thinking, you figured this out. You read the future. No, I was thinking of putting high speed downstairs. Not that there's a lot of things that need it, but if I would either like to plug in myself, because right now everything I do downstairs is wireless.
And right.
Sometimes the coverage, you know, I mean, sometimes I'd like the screaming gigabit. Yeah, you know, in theory, anyways.
Yeah, right.
But I'm thinking of actually, you know, I want to see how much is involved because I do... I find the Powerline solution compelling, though, you know, versus running a wire, it's relatively expensive. So I want to see if I can figure out how to get from one floor to another in this place without destroying it.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, we've said this many times, and since we're here, I'll say it again. If you ever are building a new room, or for whatever reason you have sheetrock down, put Ethernet cables in, because you never know when you're going to want them, and it's so easy and cheap to do before the walls are up. But you know, if it's not worth taking the walls down when there are things like power line. And I think, you know, I should look on Amazon quick here and see what the power line stuff costs now, but it's pretty cheap. It's like for the 200 megabit. So yeah, for the power line AV200 from Netgear, which is what I would recommend, for the most part, I don't see a difference in the 200 versus the 500 in terms of throughput. And you can get a pair of them for $109. So, you know, that it's, you're good to go. It's, you know, it's not $10, but it's also not $1,000. So,
you know, the last thing, maybe you know about this because you've traveled far and wide. You get lots of emails like I do. But the only other thing I'm thinking of here, and I was at least one show and they demonstrated a product that could do high speed networking via cable.
Yeah. Oh, over coax.
Over RG, yeah, whatever, your basic cable. Because actually, yep, now that I think about it, in my house, I do have cable in every room that are routed by a mysterious network of splitters and cables running around that I'm not quite sure of. So I wonder if I can use that to get from one floor to another either. Because I,
you
do
know,
believe...
You should test that. I would love to hear how that works.
Because via the wall, I'm pretty sure there's an electrical path from where the cable modem is down to the floor where I want more networking.
So. Right. Now it's really handy. I find having something wired at the TV in the living room so that, you know, the Wii or the Xbox or the TiVo or all of that cannot live on my wireless network is a really good thing. Cause it takes that traffic off of the network, especially for us. We stream, you know, I run Stream Baby, which I got working on the disc station. I think I mentioned the Synology thing, but we run Stream Baby to stream movies from our NAS drive straight to the TiVo. And, but you know, it's using some bandwidth, and I'd rather use that bandwidth wirelessly for the things that have to be wireless, like iPads and iPhones and things like that. So yeah, you should get some of those and test them. I bet you could even get some review units, John, of the coax stuff to test. That would be a great.
Yeah, it's in a pile somewhere. But I remember I saw the company. I'm like, oh, that's it. Well, at least one company that said, hey, you know, here's another solution. There are some people that have RG, you know, cable TV or cable modem quality cable running all over the place. And why not use that to beam things back and forth? And it's like, well, yeah, sure.
Yeah, why not?
And they kind of do already, but it's a different, you know, rather than being a cable modem, it's an endpoint, I guess. Or maybe it is kind of a cable modem.
All right. Yeah, it could be. It could be. All right. Where are we? Where are we time-wise anyway? All right, good. Let's talk about this. This one from MacTad in the forums, John, is probably a good one to talk about. MacTad writes, I was hunting in my keychains for the user and password combination for a site when the search turned up something that to me seems very odd. It was a certificate that seemed to give some Hungarian individual or machine root authority on my Mac. Can you tell me what this is? And he put a screenshot in, and it shows Netlock Minisiet Kodz, I don't know, something, some Hungarian thing that I'm going to totally botch if I try to pronounce it any more than I did. But it said this certificate is valid, and it is called root certificate authority. As it turns out, you want to tell them what this is, John? This is you probably already know, but do you want to tell them?
Well, I'll try to explain it. So what is a certificate? A certificate is a piece of information that, for the most part, proves that someone is who they say they are.
Right.
And there's a whole group of them that are stored on your Mac that are submitted by people who we're going to assume are trustworthy. So basically what happens is that if you're using a certificate and it's involved in sending email and connecting to other websites, if the certificates on both ends are ones that are known and trusted, then you see nothing, which is good. That's the way it should work. But if a certificate is not known or trusted, then it's going to set up an alarm. Now, the ones that this all hinges on is that these root certificates, and these are provided by the people that issue these things called certificates. And you assume if you get a certificate from them that it's trustworthy.
Well, and taking that one step further, Apple has gone out of their way, but they have provided us in terms of, you know, as a core part of the OS, this list or these certificates from the root authorities that are implicitly trusted unless you go and change them. So Apple has, in theory, vetted them and said anybody that relies on this authority, they're good to go. And it, I believe this Hungarian one that MacTad found is one of those that Apple has rubber stamped and said, yes, yep, it's good.
Yeah. I mean, normally I don't trust Hungarians, but in this case,
okay, that's John there, folks. Why would you not trust Hungarians?
Oh no, I know many Hungarians.
I know.
No, but I want to say that the quickest way for this to make sense, because what we're saying now probably doesn't transmit too well over just words. What you want to do is get the keychain access application, and then you're going to see different keychains. And the one you want to look at here, the two you want to click on the left-hand side of the application are system roots and certificates. And then you're going to see all of these, including this one that I saw here. But I also saw, I mean, there are just, you know, I'm looking now, Belgium. I mean, every country has people that issue these certificates, including countries you and I have never heard of, Dave. Like, what was it again?
Well, this was Hungary.
Hungary.
I mean, I've heard of Hungary.
Now, the problem is, now you may have seen this, a mini tangent here, but this is something to be aware of, is that there have been cases where the technology used to generate their certificate or some other, or maybe a part of their certificate has all of a sudden been compromised. So what happened, and they've had a few scares where what happens is someone has figured out how to impersonate one of these root certificates.
Right.
And normally what should happen, now this is getting kind of geeky and I don't want to scare people or anything, but they had some cases like this where you, in theory, if you went to a website that said it was secure, it really wasn't, because someone figured out how to forge the root certificate. But fortunately, I think in that case, Apple acted quickly and, you know, always keep your software update on, kids. And if it's a security update, this is one of the things that it can take care of.
Yep. 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 All right. Are you ready to talk to us? Well, actually, we'll have we'll play a question from Lou. How's that sound, John? Let me find it in here. You ready? Here we go.
Ready, pretty.
All right.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Lou calling. I have a question. My dad just asked me to update him to Mountain Lion. So we did the update and discovered that all of his ClarisWorks, because he was still using it, are no longer accessible. We downloaded pages and we can get some of them, but we have some older ClarisWorks files that just can't be opened. What do you recommend, and how might we get his files into a usable format? You can reach me.
All right, we'll cut you off there, Lou. If you couldn't hear that because of the audio, he's looking for a way to get access or read his ClarisWorks files. So, John, did you do some digging on this one?
Well, a little digging in what you mentioned. So at least to talk about a starting point here. So one thing, so this is an older application.
Right. Very. Yeah. Yeah.
That runs, I'm pretty sure it's pre Mac OS X, right, Dave?
No, it ran under Mac OS X, but it was never compiled for Intel. So it always required Rosetta to run. And I believe the problem there was, obviously we can't run Rosetta anymore in the current or even one iteration of the OS back. Right. It was an OS X thing, I think. But either way, you can't run it in Mountain Lion. You need something else.
Right. So one solution, so a quick solution here, but it requires you to have a specific setup. But I thought I'd mention it, is that most of the solutions that I saw online, I'll pick a few, but and we'll list them, of course. But said, hey, you know, if you're in ClarisWorks, then the best solution here is to write it out as Word and like get the heck out of ClarisWorks. And that makes a lot of sense. But then
that's if you can launch ClarisWorks. But if you can't.
Right. And here's the fun part. So You know, there were two parts of this. So one, I think, and Dave, you hinted at this, and I've had some experience with this, and I just wanted to offer my experience with it, but it's something called sheep shaver. And it has a picture of a sheep and some clippers and wool and all that. You get it. But
right.
Basically, what it's doing is letting you run, well, looking at their page here, I mean, pretty much it lets you run Mac OS 752 to 904.
Okay.
And I believe there was ClarisWorks in that world. So one... So you may have to, I don't think any of this is really legally a problem anymore. So to run Sheep Shaver, you got to get yourself ROMs for the older machines. And yeah, technically maybe that's naughty, but it's like, come on guys. Right.
Right.
Well, right. They tell if you have enough Google foo, you'll figure out how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, go to the Sheep Shaver page. They'll start directing you in the right direction. So yeah, that you're right. That is one way. Of course, you then also have to have a copy of Mac OS 9, right? Or 8 to run ClarisWorks. But presumably, if you still have access to ClarisWorks, then yes, this is a way to go ahead and run those apps inside of OS 10. It as Lou alluded, and obviously this doesn't work for all ClarisWorks files, but it does work for the later versions of ClarisWorks files. Pages is built to read them. So because ClarisWorks, of course, was owned by Apple and then became AppleWorks, which then sort of, you know, went into this weird murky place. And then now we have Pages. So Apple does, you know, Apple does have the access to the code and they made Pages read some ClarisWorks stuff. I'll mention this. I don't know if this will read ClarisWorks stuff because I don't have any ClarisWorks files to test with, but there is a website called Zamzar, ZAMZAR.com. And it is like the all in one document conversion site. You upload a file to them. It's all done via the web. You can see it right at zamzar.com. You pick what you want to convert it to. You put in your email address, and then it does the conversion. Now, you have to trust them. They are doing the conversion on their end. So, obviously, if the data is at all sensitive, probably not a good idea to send it off. Not that Zamzar has ever had any problems, but, you know, just good practice. But otherwise... Zamzar has worked very well for me. I have, I've used it for, you know, WordPerfect stuff that's come in and just weird, you know, weird stuff. So that's Zamzar. Anything
whatever
else?
Happened?
Oh yeah. Go ahead.
Trying to figure what happened to these guys and if it would still even apply, but Documents to Go, remember Databiz and those guys? Well, I'm looking right now, but the thing is I just went to their webpage. And it seems it doesn't appear that they make their software for the desktop anymore. It's just for the handheld devices.
Right. Yeah, that's well, no, they have a Mac version.
OK, I'm trying to find it. I must be looking in the wrong place.
Well, yeah, if you go to I just went to dataviz.com and let me see if I can get there and go to products and documents to go. And so this is weird. If you go to the iPhone platform page, then there is a application for Mac and Windows, but maybe that's only to interface with the iOS versions. I don't know.
No, but I also remember that they used to be like the, at one point they,
yeah, they were the ones
just about everything.
Yeah. I don't think they will. They don't list, ClarisWorks on there anymore.
No.
Yeah. I think they, well, you know, they probably have.
Oh, come on, Dataviz. Come on, guys.
They're just right down the road from you in Trumbull.
Oh, well, they used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think they, you know, they had to change their business. They don't, you know, there's not as much of a need for that anymore. Mm. All right. Let's move on to Michael here. Michael writes, I have a question about iTunes library sharing. My kids are heading to college with much of our music accumulated over the years in all in one iTunes library. What is the best way for them to have access to that music while they are away at school? Is iTunes Match a solution? Well, Mike, I'm actually really glad you mentioned iTunes Match, because I don't think I would have thought of that as the answer here. But I think it's actually the best answer here. There's a limitation that you should know about with iTunes Match that may matter. You can have a maximum of 10 devices. That's iOS devices and macOS devices, or OS 10 devices combined. It used to be that only 5 of those could be computers, but based on some knowledge base articles that I've read, I believe that has changed. We actually have a question into Apple about it, but have not heard back on with confirmation of that. But I believe you could, I think you could have 10 computers as long as you didn't have any iOS devices attached to this. But it's you know, iTunes Match would be a great solution, because what happens is, you know, you have your Mac that uploads everything or matches everything to the library, to the cloud. And of course that has everything on it. But then any other Mac that you connect to iTunes Match under the same account, if you have songs on that one, it will match those up. But then it shows you your whole library as though it lives on your Mac, but it'll show a little icon that says, no, this file doesn't yet live on your Mac. It's in the cloud. And then as soon as you go to play it, it pulls it down and it plays it. So that could work really, really well for the kids away at school, as long as you can live within your 10 device limit. If you want to manage that limit inside iTunes on your Mac, you go click on the iTunes store on the left and then click on your account name, which sort of appears in the upper right. It'll ask you for your password, and then you'll be brought to the account information page. There's a section in there called iTunes in the Cloud, which is synonymous with iTunes Match. Don't ask me why. And if you click in there, if you look in there, it'll tell you about your subscription, including the number of devices attached. If you click on Manage Devices there, you can see and also remove which individual devices are also there. So that may be your magic little, that may be the solution. Any thoughts on that, John?
No.
No.
Okay. No.
All right. You want to talk about the other Michael's question, John?
Oh, this one ruled.
The mysterious launching apps at login.
It was pretty mysterious, I think.
Well, you know, there you go.
Okay. Let's see. Where did we start here? Okay. So here's the start of the question here. I kind of jump in the middle here. Somewhere along my migration path, I seem to have picked up an issue. I'm hoping you can provide some diagnostic pointers to help me resolve it. Whenever I log into my main account, you like how I jumped in at the right point there, Dave?
It's very nicely done, my friend.
And I rooted everything.
Okay. That's right.
Whenever I log into my main account.
Yeah.
The preview app is doing a little dance in the dock and my browser Chrome launches. Preview showing the following error. The file, blah, 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 couldn't be opened because you don't have permission to view it. Now, let's not be distracted here by the red herring that is the permissions. That's not the problem. The problem is this is happening at all. So to continue, and I don't know if we need to continue much more here.
No, I think you're good. Yeah. Why would this happen every time?
Why would this happen every time? And I'm not quite sure why. But actually, I am. Now I am. Because I did this once. So one of the things I like to do when I have some free time is to just go into the system preferences and just poke around and just play with things and add things and delete things and then just wreak havoc so that I can call Dave and have him help me solve my problems that I caused myself. So, but the one place that's very interesting that I think doesn't get a lot of press is when you go into system preferences accounts. Then you click on your account on the left-hand side of the screen, and then you'll see login items. And most of what you'll see is probably stuff that's been placed there by applications that you use from day to day, or maybe some Apple stuff. Like right now, I see Airport Base Station Agent. And most of the other stuff is third-party stuff here. Actually, all the rest of it is all third-party stuff. Now, most of them are type application. But the thing is, you can put a lot more here, and this is why I say Apple really doesn't publicize this, is that, so putting an application here, it's kind of obvious what happens. It launches it when you log in. But if you put other things here, or I guess just the fact that you can put other things here makes it kind of interesting. So you can not only put applications, which some may need to run when you launch a machine, but you may put documents in here. What sort of documents, you may ask? Well, one type could be an image file. And that's where I led Michael down that path. I said, well, you know, the only time I've seen this, did it for me was when he mentioned, oh, well, here was the other additional information he offered. And this is what clinched it for me. So one, I knew in the back of my mind, this was part of the account information. But when he said, oh, by the way, this does not happen when logging into my admin account, then the light bulb lit up and exploded and shattered glass everywhere. Sorry. Back to the show. So that cool. Well, once he said it was only happening with another account, then that clinched it for me. And that, yes, it must be login items.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, we got an email back with, oh, and this was just a warm fuzzy here, with a screenshot showing, hey, look what I found in login items. And basically there were, I guess, two different things, which were obviously, I think, so some remnants from a photo application that put a link to an album that then broke and never went away.
Yep. Yep.
So that's pretty much it. So the thing I'd like to add is that, you know, for example, Dave, I think it still works in Mountain Lion, is that, so obviously based on this, which was accidental, but if you do put a document in there, it'll launch it. And maybe you want that, you know, a picture of something that you like.
Sure.
You want to see it every time. Though I'd probably do it as a desktop pattern or something like that rather than launching preview. But the other thing that occurs to me is launching a file server, I think, is the most unusual use of the login items.
I do it all the time. Yeah, I put my my NAS drives in my login items, and then it automatically connects to them when I start up my Mac, and they're just mounted right there in the Finder, ready to go.
Yeah, so it's certainly not obvious that this is a way to get your computer to mount network volumes every time you boot it up.
Agreed.
Or at least I've never seen an Apple tutorial, but that's why you're listening to us, because right. This is just the cool thing to do. And then if you have the login stored in your keychain, you remember it, then it makes your boot up experience all the easier.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's and you know, you touched on this, but this is one of the reasons that we suggest creating a test user account so that you can test things, and so that you're not so that you have a way around this. If in fact, let's say there was something there that was causing you trouble more than just a nuisance, you could log in under your test user account and get in there and fix some of this stuff, or at least confirm that it's not happening there. It really helps from a troubleshooting standpoint to be able to say, does this problem happen to every user on the machine? It really helps narrow down exactly where you've got to look for any problems. So good stuff. All right, John. Take him on to David's question.
Hmm?
David's question.
Oh, man.
You want me to read it? I'll read it. I've got it.
You know what? I think it's better that you read this one.
Fair enough. David writes, a few episodes back, you discussed malware on the Mac, and John said he had installed Sophos, a free anti-malware app. Taking John's lead, I installed the app on my MacBook. A few days ago, I was getting error messages on the MacBook stating that the hard drive was full. This didn't make any sense, as I'm a very light user with most of the drive unused. Thinking something must have been downloaded onto the hard drive that was huge and clogging the system, I used WhatSize to scan for big files. Sophos was taking up 29 gigs. Once I deleted Sophos, all has been well, and my MacBook is running fine. I wondered if John had noticed any problems like this. I'm back to my opinion now that anti-malware apps on the Mac cause more problems than they solve. John?
My opinion is that that's certainly not the case.
Well, it certainly was the case. I see. In a general sense, it's not the case. All right. Fair enough. You're entitled to your opinion, even if it's wrong. That's right.
And as are we all. So the only thing that I found, so I'm wondering here if it's not just a Sophos problem, because I have not seen it take up monstrous amounts of disk space. And I looked, and the only thing I could find, or at least the antivirus definitions, are stored in the top level library folder, and then something called Sophos antivirus. And in my case, it was about 90 megabytes. So I'm wondering if you may have another problem. So I've certainly not seen it go out of control, downloading tens of gigabytes of what it thinks are virus definitions.
It could also be log files. You know, I mean, it could be generating these on its own, not just downloading things. I've seen that happen.
Yeah. to, okay. Yeah. It could be a monstrously huge log file.
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
I saw that with Skype years ago, found it with what size, but I will point out here that, I actually do fully agree with David, not just because it fits into my wish that we will never have to run virus software on our Macs, but, especially with regards to SOFA, it's crap, guys. This software, John has had no problems with it, and that's good for John. I had problems immediately with it. It was slowing my machine down, and this is on a, you know, 4 or 8 core iMac with an SSD drive. It was slowing things down. It was causing all sorts of grief. I happened to mention it in a staff meeting recently, and everybody that had tried it, and there were like 4 other people in the meeting, and they all said, oh yeah, get that thing off your Mac. It's horrible. It's terrible. So John is the only one here at TMO that has not had problems with Sophos.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know what that says, but what it tells me is I'm going to tell you not to install it as a general piece of advice. So yeah, but you have to remember, I mean, these problems are weird. Why this thing would, you know, generate 29 gigs worth of anything is ridiculous. But I trust David that it did, you know. But in general, even good antivirus software is built to get in your way. That's what you want it to do, presuming you put it on your system. You want it to look at every file that you're, you know, accessing and make sure every app that you're running isn't infected with known bits of virus code. So it is going to slow things down to some degree. Whether it's noticeable or not obviously depends on what it's doing and how well it's doing it and all of that. But it, you know, it's there, it's resident, and it's in your way as it's supposed to be. So stay away from Sophos. That's my advice.
No.
But he did mention, that's your advice. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. He did mention a good thing though. What size, which is whatsizemac.com. This is, you know, one of these, great things. I've always used Omni Disk Sweeper for this, but, what size does the same thing in its own different way. They all will scour your hard drive and tell you where you are using all of your space. And this is something I highly recommend everyone does once every 6 months. You don't need to be obsessive about it unless you want to be, but, you know, Omni Disk Sweeper is free. What size? I'm trying to remember if what size, I don't think it is. But it's cheap. It's like $13. So if you like their interface better, go just use theirs, you know, awesome stuff. It's so handy to find those things that, you know, his was so big that it was impacting him. So he, you know, he knew there was something out there. But like I said, I found, you know, Skype, I had been doing some testing for him and I'd turned on all these like weird logging features. And I had this, you know, 2 gig log file on this machine. It was really nice to find that and, you know, remember, oh yeah, I got to turn that off and delete the file. So really handy to find stuff out there. You know, really good stuff. Do you use Omni Disk Sweeper or one of those, John?
Not really, though. I was looking for the name of a utility, which Sophos did make me aware of because it does interact with some of the lower level parts of the system here. And it's, what's that utility that tells you when people are futzing with your launch agents?
Oh yeah. There was that. Yeah. It's just a little thing that sits and runs, a folder watcher kind of thing that watches your launch agents. Yeah. We got
to
find
it. Yeah. That. We'll find it and link to
we'll
it.
Put it in the show.
No, the thing is that Sophos is the one utility that regularly alerts me that it's messing with things in those folders because the nature of how they implement their software makes it. So they got to change those plist files.
Oh,
so regularly it says, hey, yeah, I changed those. You want to see what changed? I'm like, nah, I know.
Yeah, no, it's handy. John's talking about this script. We'll find it. And it just sits and watches, you know, several folders on your Mac for any changes, which is handy because, you know, things can pop stuff out there and it's good to know. Mac Tech Freak in the chat room, in addition to Omni Disk Sweeper and What Size, mentioned Daisy Disk, which is yet another thing. It's $10, But this will also find your disk space used, and it's got a cool interface, and actually it looks really cool. So check that out too. We'll put them all in the show notes. All right. Are we done ranting about Sophos, John?
I wasn't ranting.
I guess that was me. All right. Brooks writes, I hope you can provide me a bit of guidance as I try to boost the speed, performance, and reliability of my current mid-2010 Mac Pro, 2.8 gigahertz quad core, 13 gigs of RAM, 1066 megahertz running Mountain Lion with Parallels. I also use two terabyte external drives for clones and Time Machine backups, which is now maxed out. I have recently just purchased a 256 gig SSD and another external 2 terabyte drive and would like to, number one, use the SSD as the boot drive and applications drive. I believe this would need to be partitioned to accommodate Parallels and personal Quicken files. Number two, I want to use the existing internal 1 terabyte rotational drive in the iMac as a source drive for working files, as well as keeping a copy of the OS and apps. And number three, I want to use the two terabyte external drives for rotated clones and backups. What is the best way to accomplish this? Okay, so let's talk about this, because there's a lot of people in your shoes here that are, you know, as opposed to replacing Macs, just updating them and really adding SSDs is a common practice. Number one, I would stay far away from partitioning anything unless you have a very, very specific reason that it totally makes sense and it's the only way to do it. Running Parallels does not require a partition. Parallels will just create its own drive file, but that doesn't need to be on its own partition. And with an SSD, you're not going to get any speed benefits from making sure it's on a partition and it, you know, doesn't get fragmented and all of that, because that problem doesn't exist on SSDs. So I would not partition the drive. I would just put Parallels on it and put your Quicken data on it, and you're good to go. As far as getting everything there, he was asking whether he should install Fresh on this SSD or use Migration Assistant. I would say Migration Assistant is going to be okay, you know, doing the install over the top and all of that stuff. We've seen very, very good luck with that with Mountain Lion. But because you're not going to be storing your user data on the same drive, you're probably better off just doing a clean install and sort of managing that process manually. It will require installing new apps, but it also saves you the time of cloning from the existing drive over. The one thing you may want to partition for is, you said that you wanted to have your internal drive have your user data and also as a backup for your keeping a working copy of the OS as a, you know, sort of a clone. That would make sense to put on a separate partition, because then you can unmount it and it's out of your way, and all you see mounted is your user files, and you don't have two copies of a bootable OS up there all the time. So that would make sense. But yeah, otherwise I would just go with full drives and not partition and just blaze ahead. That's my feeling anyway. John, what do you think, my friend?
I'm with you. Partitions cause problems.
Yeah.
It begins with a P. P problems. I've never had... Now, fortunately, the latest version of OS 10, of course, lets you repartition for the most part if you do make a mistake. But yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. I will link to an article that Ted Landau did at TMO about his life, you know, managing his multi-drive life, and may have some pointers. Somebody in the chat room mentioned linking your home directory from your SSD to the well, no, that's actually a really good idea if you want to keep your documents.
That's a terrible idea.
Well, if it's an internal drive, it's always going to be mounted.
Well, I not that it's a terrible, it's just it leads you to a dialogue that can get kind of scary. So, right?
No. Well, you can edit. What John's talking about is if you go into System Preferences and you go into users and groups, as it is called in Mountain Lion, and you right click in the list of users, you'll see advanced options. And, you know, you right click on your user account and go to advanced options. You can change the home directory there. That's certainly one way of doing it. The other way is just to do a symlink, although I guess it's probably better to do it here in this advanced setting, but only change the home directory. Don't muck with anything else. And you'll be fine. As John pointed out, you can really screw things up if you change other options here. So, but yeah, that would be the way to do it, I think, anyway. You want to do, I want to get some tips in. We'll skip Cool Stuff Found this week, John, because I think we're going to do an entire Cool Stuff Found show for our next show, because we've got some scheduling things to work out. So Cool Stuff Found is a good thing to slip in there. We've got some tips we want to get through. You want to do Fred quick, or do you want to save Fred for a show where we can really like dig in deep?
I don't know if we really have to dig in too deep with Fred right, here.
Then go.
So the biggest challenge here is going to be finding Fred's feedback.
As it always is, it seems. Well, you know, there are ways to organize what do you this do stuff.
I got it right in front of me here.
Good. Okay, go ahead.
Now, should we do the drive or the troubleshooting? I guess the troubleshooting.
All right. Yeah, go ahead.
Or the drive first. Well, all right. I'm going to sum it up here. So Fred had a number of questions here. All revolving, I think, about external drives and USB. So we're going to hit the first one here. He's basically looking for advice on purchasing a Mac, has been using Windows systems for about 30 years. Goodness. And he's going to get a MacBook Pro. So question one, what is better to have, FireWire 800 or USB 3 for daily backup? And he likes the idea of AirPort Extreme. So I would say the results as follows. Now, one, I can back this up, at least with one configuration I've used, and I'm actually curious about your experience, Dave. So USB 3 or FireWire. Now, looking at the numbers or the bandwidth of either one, USB 3 kind of wins. And actually, I did a test to confirm this. So the thing you got to keep in mind is USB and FireWire are different, and the USB, I think, tends to use more processor, whereas FireWire really doesn't. There are a few other differences, but just in a nutshell. Yeah. The thing is, I did a test of, so CalDigit let me test one of their drives, and I tried it on a number of configurations. And basically, I tried both USB 3 and FireWire interface, and USB 3 was faster. So,
yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
That's kind of my vote there. And what is interesting is that a lot of vendors, it seems, I can't say that this was the cause, but it seemed to be a big coincidence, is as soon as Apple announced the first USB 3 port on their portable, it seemed a whole bunch of vendors, and I don't know, I think Apple like orchestrated this, but all of a sudden I saw all these vendors offer, hey, by the way, we got a drive with USB 3 and something else.
Right.
There was just like a flood of people that, and most of the time it was FireWire. So it was like, hey, we got USB and 3. So I don't know if it was like the company that made the chip that does this just released them all of a sudden or what, but it just seems right now there's a lot of choice in that USB 3 market. So maybe I think Apple did kind of push to make that happen.
Perhaps. Yeah. 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 Or perhaps, so many people follow Apple now that that's sort of validation that, okay, yeah, we're going to go with this.
So. Or the Thunderbolt was just kind of disappointing, and in my humble opinion, was not rolled out very well. Right?
It's
how many Thunderbolt peripherals do you have?
See, that's the thing. I think you're looking at it the wrong way, and now we're in a completely
Would
different
that be
discussion.
None?
It is none. Yeah, I haven't bought any, but Thunderbolt is not. See, You're comparing Thunderbolt to USB 3 and they are two completely different things.
I understand.
I know, but perhaps our listeners don't. And by you saying that, you're leading them down the wrong path. Thunderbolt is USB and FireWire are interfaces for hanging, peripherals off of, whereas Thunderbolt can be used that way, but it is like putting a card into your computer. It has direct access to the motherboard. So really, it's an expandability thing. It's if there's some, let's say down the road, you want to add, you know, USB 4 to your Mac, right? Or, you know, whatever the next great interface is with Thunderbolt, you can do that because you can go from Thunderbolt to USB 4. The USB port in your Mac is plugged into the motherboard. Thunderbolt gives you that mainline access to the motherboard to add capabilities that your Mac does not have out of the gate. Now, there are people that are using it effectively as an eSATA interface, right? Because you're plugging, there are no Thunderbolt drives out there. There are drives with Thunderbolt ports, but the drives have eSATA. The drive itself is an eSATA interface inside the box. Thunderbolt effectively gives you a mainline from the motherboard to that eSATA thing without having to go through USB or FireWire. It takes one layer out of the mix. So it just, Thunderbolt allows you this wide variety of expansion options because you're not limited to the USB or FireWire interfaces that came with your Mac. So I think Thunderbolt is a brilliant move, actually. It's just been very, very misunderstood and misrepresented by, frankly, by a lot of the press. But
yeah,
you know, it's because it's not USB and FireWire and Thunderbolt. It's like Thunderbolt underneath and then whatever interface you want on top of it. So I think it will give more life to the iMac I bought last year because it has a Thunderbolt port. So I can do whatever cool. I want with it.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right. Well, I'm going to get USB 3 then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, USB. Yeah. Well, for Fred's advice, but really the question that Fred asked that I thought would be good to go through in the show was about, he had gone down the USB 3 path. And you had some advice for him in diagnosing USB 3 issues.
Yes.
So maybe walk through that and then we'll get to some of these tips.
Yeah. And that's some fun. Yeah. So he was saying, I was reading a user's review. So he was looking at USB 3 drives and one of the reviewers stated he had a USB 3 cable problem. He was able to test the transfer speed of the drive to point to a problem with the cable. So his question is, now remember, Fred's coming here from a PC background.
Yep.
How do you do this on the Mac? And that's a great question. How do you find out how fast your drive is talking? Windows has a utility and the Mac has some utilities to do this as well. And actually, you know what? I just thought of one while I was going to talk about the one that I recommended. So the one I'm going to recommend, but you know, I'm going to do that one first here. So how can you tell the throughput when you're transferring data to or from a drive? And I'm going to say to me the best solution, don't cost money, is iStat menus.
Oh, yeah.
And that it has a menu specifically showing all your drives and the read and write speed to or from that drive. So that's a great sign. So one, you got to do some research and figure out, well, what's the ballpark transfer rate for the device that I'm talking to? And sometimes you may have to take the value that's the theoretical maximum and have it or well, maybe it's in the specs, but don't always, never, I would say almost never ever expect anything to reach the throughput that the interface advertises. I think USB 3 can do what, up to 6 gigabits, I think, or 5 gigabits or something gigabits, right? I'm sure Dave is typing away furiously to see if I'm correct in that.
You want USB 3 speed? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I have it here. I had it right up on my screen and now I can't find it, John. USB 3 speed is that's USB 2. 5 gigabits. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. 5 gigabits.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you could figure maybe that's 500 megabytes, maybe in the ballpark of.
Yeah.
So look at the drive, see the transfer speed. Now we find that unusual, though. You know, USB 3, so it's a different cable from USB 2, but they're backward compatible. So you can plug a USB 2 cable into a USB 3 port. I think it just uses certain wires. And I think what USB 3 gives you is a couple more wires for the data transfer, better wires. I don't know.
Right.
But no, in my tests, all right, another thing is hardware growler.
Right? Oh, yeah.
You got to buy also. Hardware Growler operates at a very low level and basically gives you via Growl, or I think on its own, the product's changed a little bit along with Mac OS X. But basically it shows whenever you connect or disconnect a USB, a FireWire, a network, or pretty much any device. And it kind of shows it in two stages, which I think is the cool thing, is that so first it shows you pretty much at the device level. Like if you plug in a flash drive, it's like, oh, it's a USB blah blah flash something. Then the next level, it's like, oh, this is John's thumb drive. But I like that because if there is a cable problem and like the device is connecting and disconnecting and connecting and disconnecting and connecting, and you get the idea.
I got the idea.
This is definitely going to show that. Right. And I've had that happen with bad cables or bad hubs or bad whatever. If there's a device on your network, whether it be Ethernet or USB or FireWire or whatever, and it's jumping up and down, connecting and disconnecting, Hardware Growler will absolutely show that. And a bad cable could be the problem.
Yeah, no, totally.
What's another thing in my tool belt here? Let me see. I think I had one other one. My stat menus, Hardware Growler. It's built in, but you can also see, I believe, some basic drive throughput information in Activity Monitor. Right? Yeah, I'm looking here.
Can you? Well, yeah, maybe it does. I've gotten so used to using
disk usage. Okay. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Right. Disk activity.
Yep. That's right.
So Activity Monitor has a disk activity tab, and that will show data read, data written, and also per second throughput. So,
yeah,
And it has a little graph, so it's better than nothing, but I really like iStat menus. It shows you everything that's happening.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on.
Well, and the nice part about iStat menus is that Activity Monitor shows you overall disk I/O usage, but it does not break it down by device, whereas iStat menu shows you for every disk that you've got what the throughput is. And that's really handy, I've found, for testing out speeds or diagnosing problems. So. All right. Let's see. Let's go through we've got a couple of tips here that we can run through. In the last show we talked about EXIF data where people wanted to see what phone took what picture, and Andrew suggested simply use different apps to take those pictures, and that will store different data in the meta tags, the EXIF data for the photos. So I like that idea. Yeah, it's not as convenient because you can't just swipe up and use the camera. But there are some decent third-party camera apps out there, though I seem to keep gravitating back toward the one that's built into the phone just because it's built into the phone. Let's see. Eric has one of those things that may be obvious if you've done it, but not obvious if you haven't. So take it away, Eric.
Hello, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. Eric here. I thought I would pass along a quick tip with the Reminders app found on iOS and now Mountain Lion. A while back, I remember Dave lamenting that iCal did not have the ability to create repeating to-dos that would come back every month or so. The Reminders app does have this ability. If you set a reminder, you can adjust it to repeat once a month. I have a repeating monthly reminder. I've got several set up actually, and it's pretty useful. Just thought I'd pass along that quick tip in case, Dave, you had not noticed it. Thanks a lot. Don't get caught.
Hey, thanks, Eric. And I think that was Eric's son at the very beginning of the question there. I had not noticed that. I knew that it was it's always been a feature that Calendar Store on the Mac supported, but Apple had no user interface for doing this. iCal would not. So I obviously moved to BusyCal a long time ago and never thought about it when Mountain Lion came out to check the Reminders app to see if it gave you a way to access this functionality. There is one, and it does. So thank you, Eric. That's a good thing. There is one weird thing about it, and you will experience this if you have BusyCal or if you use the Reminders app, because they're all kind of pointing at the Calendar Store right there on your Mac. And that is, if you have, let's say you have a to-do every Wednesday to take the trash out, right? If let's say 1 week your trash is delayed by a day because of a holiday or something, and you move that to-do to Thursday, following weeks will then be on Thursday. If it carries through because it's a held over to do. So, you know, if it's a past due to do when you click it, when you mark it done, it will put the next one in for, you know, for Wednesday, because that's what it was from. But if you manually move it to another day, that will change your cycle. And that's bit me quite a few times. So, so I just wanted to point that out there. So good stuff. All right. And we'll wrap up with some tips from Karsten, because he's always got great tips. So, number one, Karsten says, using mail in Mountain Lion, he says, you can do notifications by the use of the VIP feature. When you first start using Mountain Lion 10.8 and configure your email, notifications are set to alert you to every single email that comes into your inbox. In my case, I do not need nor want to see all that. I only want to see notifications from special people. To do that, first, locate the email message from the people you want to be notified about. On the right-hand side, you can read the message. And when you look at the from name, on the left side of that name is a small empty star. That is the VIP indicator. If you click that, that sets this person as VIP. Now repeat this process until you have marked all of your VIPs. Now go to the notifications section. By going up and clicking on the little notifications thing in the upper right hand corner, or doing the two finger swipe. If you can do that with your pointing device, select mail and change notifications from banners to alerts and close the window. This ensures that when you receive a message from a VIP, it sticks to the screen and doesn't go away. The last step actually happens back in mail. Select the mail menu, go to preferences, go to the general tab, go to new message notifications and change that from inbox only to VIPs. Now you'll get notified from special people, and the notifications will stick to the screen so you can open them from wherever you are. It's a good tip. I like it. Next tip is the quick scroll to the top tip. Certainly exists in Mountain Lion. He says, I'm not sure if this is new to Mountain Lion or not. If you have scrolled several messages down and you need to go to the top, place your cursor on the small gray bar somewhere next to the sort by text and double tap. It will scroll you all the way back to the top in mail. So that's handy. All right. Let's I think that should do it here. Let me see if I can find the band here, John.
That's it.
Well, you know, we've been at this for almost an hour and a quarter, or perhaps past an hour and a quarter. Yeah, past an hour and 18
minutes.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Let's see. As we said, MacGeekab 415 will not be recorded on Sunday night. That we know for sure. We may do it on Thursday, or we may do it on Monday night, Labor Day. Here's the secret that I'll let you all in on. We are very, very close to God, this noise gate's acting weird here on the music. We're very close to rolling out the new design, which is also a completely new backend for the Mac Observer. We are going to do a dry run of that on Tuesday, and then the main launch is actually scheduled for the evening of Labor Day, which would preclude me from being able to record this show. But I have this sneaking feeling that our dry run is going to go fairly well on Tuesday, and we may actually just launch it Tuesday night. So if that's the case, then we're wide open to do the show. If not, we might record the show on Thursday, and we'll go from there. And while we're in the projects phase of the show here, the Mac Geekab app is about to be resubmitted. We got denied for two reasons. One was
Denied.
That's right. One was a technical issue because we were storing data in a way that made it get backed up to iCloud and it shouldn't. So that was, they were certainly right to do that. And we'll fix that. And the other is I'd completely forgotten in our MacGeekab logo in the glasses is the Finder icon. I'd completely forgotten that that's where that came from.
Do you believe there's some sort of trademark or something on that?
Uh-huh. I don't believe it. They told me there was, and they said
not the word Mac. So they didn't care about the word.
No,
Mac.
The word Mac was not the problem. It was the Finder icon in the logo.
Trademarked. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you notice, this show has it. We've scrubbed the Finder icon out of the logo. I actually want to do something different there. Right now, it's just a fade. But so if anybody has any ideas, I can certainly provide you with an Illustrator file if you want to mess around with it, or even if you're not graphically inclined and you just have an idea, let us know. And if you want to let us know your idea, or if you have a question, or perhaps anything else, you can email us at feedback@mackeycab.com. Right, John?
Mm-hmm.
You with me on this? How you doing over there? We have
a little shtick that we do.
So I said feedback@mackeycab.com.
All right. If you want the shtick, but I want cookies. But if you want the shtick, yes, it is feedback@mackeycab.com.
And those of you that are premium members, and the good news is that the new premium thing will roll out pretty much in line with the new TMO design, because it relies on the new backend that we're doing. You can email us at premium@mackeycab.com, and those do get prioritized in their answers. We try to get to them many times a week. I don't want to say every day, even though I actually do try to get to them every day. But certainly multiple times a week that mailbox is perused. So that's premium@mackeycab.com.
So you said not only premium@mackeycab.com, but feedback@mackeycab.com.
That's right.
Okay. Just want to make sure I covered.
And once the app comes out, you'll be able to send us audio comments directly from within the app. But if you want to send us an audio comment now, you can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4,335. What is going on out there? Oh, boy.
Sounds like they're coming to get you, man.
You hear
those,
that?
Those black helicopters were just the recon crew. All right, quickly then, you can find us on Twitter. Mac Geekab will find you the show and announcements when the show comes out, but also when we're doing our live stream.
Oh, there we go. Fire.
All right. John F. Braun is him, and he's in like squirrel mode now. Pilot Pete is that guy that always seems to be flying when we're recording here. And I am Dave Hamilton on Twitter. You can also find us on Facebook, which is a great way to keep tabs on when we do these recordings, because we create them as Facebook events. So if you like us on Facebook, it helps. And that's facebook.com/MacGeekGab. And again, the stream is MacGeekGab.com/stream. So that's where we have a nice chat room going. And it really is a lot of fun. Anything to add before we push this one out the door, my friend?
Zero.
Well, that's enough
to
for
add,
me.
I'm at my limit.
Okay. We'd like to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast for converting this and all the shows to AAC. Cashfly for all the bandwidth. BB Edit from Barebone Software. PDF Pen Pro from Smile. And Gazelle, all in the podcast marketplace this month. Have a great month. Have a great Labor Day weekend, if you're in the U.S. here. And John, you might have one last piece of advice. You got to have something left in the tank.
Don't get caught.
Made up.